Second edition of the Legislative Revenue Committee, Senate Revenue Committee. We're going to continue with our orientation for the duties and responsibilities of the committee with anticipated issues that we'll be facing for this legislative session. And what I'll ask our committee of staff to do is just go through a list of the subject areas that have come to us from various sources in the building, and obviously this does not incorporate all of the potential issues that members may bring or that we may have referred later in the session, but it's a sort of a radar screen for things that might be coming. So, Paul, just go ahead and help us through this orientation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things before I get started. One of the things I neglected to do yesterday was introduce you to our Revenue Department representatives that will be with us throughout the session. Deb Buchanan, who's with the Corporate and Income Tax Division, and John Phillips from Property Tax. So they are a long-standing relationship with this committee and have been a resource to you for issues that come up when the bills come before you.
Thank you. Welcome. Good morning.
And the other issue, Mr. Chair, is there was some concern about our overhead last time and the copies you received, and so I did provide a colored version in particular for Senator Nimitz. So I didn't do the color background, so we saved on the cost that way, but on the graphs where the colors help distinguish things, you'll find that in your overhead. If that helps.
Yeah, it does. And, Mr. Chairman, you can just give it to me on a disc if you want. I can take them home and print them out on my color printer.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. As the Chair Ferrioli stated, we have been spending the last few weeks or so talking with both the Senate and House chairs and others, and of course the work of the interim committees. And what you have before you is just really a listing of issues that we see out there, potential issues. These are things that may or may not take a lot of your time, but at this point, I think, given the experience we've had in the last few years, that they're likely to come up before you. And we certainly, if the bills come through, we've seen bills in just about all of these areas. The first one is on schools. And as we when we were discussing the role of the committee yesterday, we emphasized the importance of the formula in the school distribution system. We have a state school fund, and how those dollars are allocated among the individual districts is determined by the school distribution formula. That has traditionally been a role of the Revenue Committee to review that formula. It's an extremely powerful formula because the weights within that formula have a significant impact on individual districts and how many dollars they receive. So I've listed some areas that we've heard some discussion about, again, from interim committees and bills that we've seen. One in particular is concern over special education and how that's measured and how that's accounted for in the formula. Another is on districts that have declining enrollment. If you look at statewide enrollment or raw enrollment numbers, non-weighted, it's only growing about 0.5% a year. So when you think of the high-growth districts in Washington County, for example, then you realize there must be a lot of districts that are declining. And indeed, that's the case throughout the state. There are those that are declining. In our formula, we use what's called an extended ADMW or average daily membership weighted, in which you use the higher of last year or this year's enrollment, weighted enrollment numbers. Those that have declining enrollment over time have higher fixed costs. They continue to have their fixed costs, yet they see a drop in their dollars per student as the number of students decline. So that's an issue that we're hearing a lot about and one you may want to take up and consider. Another issue in the school area is one I'm sure you're aware of is federal legislation that has changed the way that federal forest receipts are allocated. What the federal government did was remove the relationship between the current timber harvest and the amount of federal dollars available to counties. On the federal forest receipts, not BLM land, but Federal Forest Service land, 25% of those dollars have gone to schools traditionally. That continues basically in place. It's a larger figure now, and there's more dollars available to schools. Under the current distribution formula, those dollars would be put into the school distribution fund and the state school fund and allocated statewide. So the current law would treat them as they currently treat federal receipts, what we call local revenue, the same basically as we treat state dollars. So that's an issue that in particular, sponsors of the bill at federal level have concerns about. So you'll see some bills in that area to take a look at that. A third area for schools is on local option. As you recall, the 99 session, we did pass a local option that was not included in the original Measure 50. So schools now have the option through House Bill 2753 from the 99 session to go before their voters and ask for dollars that what we call the property tax gap, the amount of property tax dollars that would be available between the Measure 5 limit and the Measure 50 limit. And a number of schools have done that in the state. I believe it's 14 of them that have successfully had a local option pass. We have had some interim testimony about how the schools fared in that. And one of the difficulties that we found, and we were aware of this, but it really, I think, was difficult for the schools, was trying to get a proper estimate. Because it actually, that the impact on individual property owners varies by individual property owner because the size of the gap varies. Depending on how much your market value, the difference between your real market value and your value under Measure 50, your constraining value. So that's an issue to look at. Measure 1, which was passed by the voters, sponsored, brought forth by the governor, does have some language that suggests, does not necessarily compel you, but suggests to look at alternative local option schemes, one in which there would be some type of a method that would allow those districts that have lower values per student to get some state support in conjunction with their local options. So that's something also that's on the agenda. The fourth school issue I have there is ESD equalization. The House Revenue Committee established a task force with 99 legislation. That task force has reported. We do have on the agenda a report from those that did the task force from the Department of Education, and they can go through those recommendations with you. The main focus was on equalization. We have wide variation in dollars per student across ESDs. So the task force was to make some recommendations to go in that direction and make a series of other recommendations as well. So it's a pretty comprehensive report. It was a very comprehensive process. So there's a lot of issues for you to consider in terms of ESD and ESD equalization. If you're not aware, as we've gone through the K through 12 equalization process, it really began with the passage of Measure 5 back in 1991. There really hasn't been much done on the ESD side. They were largely left out of that process. So now we're essentially beginning that process. 99 was the first step. Final school issue I have here is on school capital needs. This is the other side of the issue on declining enrollment, are those that have need to build new schools, that need the various other types of capital, desks and so forth that are associated with new schools. There's continuing pressure in those high growth districts. There's also a lot of concern for those that may not be growing in terms of enrollment but have outdated facilities that are essentially deteriorating. I'm sure you've heard a lot of stories about that. So there are capital needs out there and bills that will address that for you to consider.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Vice Chair.
Well, before you move off of schools, the legislative staff level, has there been any discussion of how and who school, I guess who is what committee, will answer the major one question about adequacy of school funding.
That's the other component, the much more publicized component of Measure 1 is the adequacy piece. The governor did issue a statement coming out why he said that his recommended budget did not meet his adequacy standards. The interpretation we have is that it really is a ways and means issue because they're determining the total size of the pot.
And before we leave the school issues, let's take a minute and talk about some of these issues, because each of us will be spending a lot of constituent contact time talking about schools. We're going to spend about 60% of the state's assets, disposable assets, on this issue. And although possibly the question of adequacy of financing gets discussed elsewhere, certainly some of the things that we'll do have real implications for how these formulas play out and the equalization questions. In the formula review, the very high student costs are for ADA, Americans with Disability Act students. We've got some districts where young people with profound disability are in the school system until age 21. And they are, the school districts are obligated to provide absolutely equal treatment and access. And that may involve nursing care in the school with teacher aid and health aid. And small school districts just have real difficulty in coping with that issue. And at some point in time, we ought to discuss placing a ceiling on costs that can attached to these ADA issues, so we don't bankrupt school districts.
Yeah, in the last session before last, put a special provision in to deal with costs of a certain amount. I can't remember exactly how that worked, but there was one that dealt with that.
Yeah,
I think it was inadequate.
I think we need to look at it. I think the school district administrators are going to ask us to look at it.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator George?
We should have today the final report from a work group I set up to look at special education, and there's some really great recommendations. I'll get a copy for everyone on this committee of their recommendations. It's a great work group, by the way. But one of the other things, the first conclusion that I began to come to is that, well, where we have a child with catastrophic disability, that those monies should follow that child, because it's impossible for a smaller district to even have one or maybe two children that would be in the $100,000 category. They can't sustain it. And I sure think that's something we think about. I don't know if you guys know if there's any bills coming in that direction.
Well, the issue is possibly one that we could do with a formulaic adjustment in this committee. So we really, that I welcome the report. I think that'll be excellent. Sorry for this.
I wanted to kind of ramble on a little bit of it. But you mentioned the issue of adequacy, or at least was mentioned by the vice chair here. And I wrote down that adequacy is determined by utilization. And I think that's really true. I think part of the committee, and correct me if I'm wrong, part of our responsibility here is to kind of explore the utilization of resources within the educational system to the extent that we can determine the value of those things, or that we can actually determine what that is. So, and I know, having served in the Ways and Means Committee and been the co-chair at one point, one of the problems was determining where is the money going, how is it actually being utilized. And I say that because one of the known problems within the Portland public school system, and one that the mayor of Portland has criticized, is not a lack of facilities, but an excess of facilities, where the Portland School District at one time had room for well over 80,000 students. Their student population is down between 47,000 and 50,000, but they still hold on to these facilities and buildings. So that to me is a question. What are they doing about it, and is there something that we can do perhaps to facilitate dealing with that issue, because they've got some other financial problems too?
I think that's an excellent opportunity.
Yeah.
Those folks that come to talk to us about these formulas I think you're going to have to make the case of utilization.
And the way I work, by the way, I usually make these kind of statements expecting that somebody from the Portland Public School System or wherever else is going to come to me and say,
I think I hear your phone ringing.
I'm expecting that I may hear from somebody out there and say, you're either wrong or you're right or whatever. So.
Then on the independent education programs, those two are issues where many administrators over the last 4 years have told me that they are just not breaking even on those reimbursements from the state, and that we need to, I think they're at are they at 11% now in reimbursements, and maybe a small percentage increase, not a lot of money in the whole scheme of things, may help them on that issue. So I'll be asking people to come forward and talk about these formulaic changes and why they think those are necessary in the courtroom.
Senator
Corcoran is right
there. They were very
comfortable. Doing very well.
Senator very Corcoran. Nice hand signals.
Senator Corcoran, when the signal...
You have the right. Hand signals I'm used to, Mr. Yeah. Chair. I guess the if this is the time to comment on sort of special needs within, you know, our own constituencies, I have 14 school districts, and only two of them are large, really, a little bit of Springfield and a little bit of 4J. But I have all these tiny rural school districts, Oak Ridge, Marcola, McKenzie, four of them down in North Douglas County. And in talking to the administrators of those and school board members there in preparation for this session, I mean, a couple of things come to mind. One is the declining enrollments. Paul's absolutely right. Those are devastating to small schools. I mean, you just can't. When you lose five students, you lose the money, but you don't lose the classroom, you don't lose the teacher, your overhead remains the same. I will never forget, and it just rings in my ears still, the Marcola school administrator saying, do not send me any more bricks and mortar. You know, I need money for school, for, you know, teaching. And you know, they just, he said, we have an arson with a social conscience in Marcola. He burned down two schools in the last 15 years. They've rebuilt the schools. They don't need bricks and mortar. They really need, you know, sort of day-to-day money. And back to the declining enrollment, one of the suggestions was to move that two-year, you know, the greatest of two, and extend that to some degree. So I'll be looking to see if we can do that. Just saying the highest of 3 years or the highest of 5 years as opposed to highest of this year and the last year.
Yeah, the theory being that it takes longer than a year or a community or to cope with a catastrophic dislocations in employment, mill closure,
right,
or you know, any number of things, restructuring of the economy in some fashion in the local community.
And then with regard to the forest money, I know there's a debate raging on both sides. Representative Morgan has a bill in that would remove all of the federal forest money from the formula. I have a bill in that would remove only that portion that represents an increase, using this year as the base year, and working with Cindy Hunt from Legislative Council. And it was, I think it amounts to, I was talking to Lee about this the other day, maybe 20, 26 million or something like that for a 2 year period. And setting that money aside for small rural schools. And of course, the Portland argument is that, you know, the per capita income is so high in Portland that they're subsidizing these small rural schools anyway. So you have subsidization on both parts, federal forest money on the one hand and the per capita income in Portland on the other. So I understand that that's going to be, you know, a struggle as well. And then the last comment I'd make is, I think Paul said the 14 local options passed in the state. We cannot pass local options in small rural communities that have no income. We cannot do it. It doesn't help.
And I think the other thing is you should recognize that some of these strategies that we're being asked to consider are at cross purposes. Mm-hmm. For instance, the forced consolidation of education service districts. ESDs are tax-supported, locally elected bodies, and no two of them serve in the same way. We had a series of forced consolidations about a decade ago. And on one hand, the legislature says, well, local option is now available. On the other hand, it says, well, we should force the consolidation of special service districts that have their own tax base and their own elected board. And those things seem incompatible to me. So, but this committee will have essentially ground zero on those very important issues. They are controversial, and they've been given to us because they directly affect the revenue stream. Mr. Co-Chair.
A couple of comments. One of the things that I think we ought to look at, and sort of to Tony's point of 3-year rolling averages, the way the formula works now, there's an adjustment. If you overestimate your enrollment at the start, your supplies, it doesn't hurt you right away, but you have to adjust it. And effectively, what it does is reduces your amount of money you get in the second year of the biennium. And I think that's a cash flow problem. And I'm not exactly sure how to deal with that one, but it makes the problem worse.
Right.
You have to take a look at that.
We also saw I guess the most charitable thing you could call it is creative finance. Where school districts were transferring on paper student enrollment and transferring on paper from one district to another and both claiming the same student population because of the one-year extension by safety net. In other words, you could claim the highest of the last 2 years enrollment.
That's pretty creative.
It was creative.
The second one is we talk about the federal force. I'm reminded of Senator Duke's always, every time this issue comes up and says, if you're going to treat the federal force receipts differently, she wants us to take another look at the state force receipts. But there are certain districts that now that all goes in the thing. She says, I guess it's the phrase is all force should be treated equally.
Well, 90, if I had a count, it was 90% state forest lands, I'd probably be looking at that too. We also need to know and pay attention to the fact that Senate Bill 1608, which is the Federal Forest Receipts Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act, extends the safety net for Westside Forest as well. So of all the districts and all the counties, I think 33 of 36 counties end up having some form of federal revenue stream either extended or created by this bill. So
that's really important.
Yeah, so it's a big thing. And Senator Castillo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to weigh in on the federal forest receipts issue because I really hope that, you know, we all do take a look at the fact that if we are going to establish public policies that result in less money for rural schools, that we do need to step up and look at that issue and take that under consideration and see how we can tweak the formula with this new money that we're going to get from the federal. That was the purpose for the bill. In my understanding, I think that's the understanding for we heard Wyden and DeFazio and other, you know, of our federal representation talk about this money. And so I'm hoping that we have a really good discussion around that and really talk about, you know, those policy issues to go along with it.
I think we'll have
one suggestion.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Since we have so many new members on the Revenue Committee, one of the things that I'd suggest that Paul may want to have people want to do is there at different times we've looked at it actually a chart, sort of a barometer chart that gets at the point that Portland makes a lot that they're paying the bill. It really shows you the mix of property taxes and income taxes that support schools by district. I think it's very instructive to see.
I think it would help. You know, the idea that We look at ESD forced equalization, and we look at the 27 recommendations that come in that report. And equalization driven by the courts in basic school funding is different than the equalization of services. You know, the dollar amount is one way to measure performance in school districts. The services provided is another way. And the issues are not as simple as just flatlining per capita income on ESD funding. So we'll get into this stuff probably deeper than any of us wants to.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator George.
Thank you. As I was listening, I had a thought and I want to share it with you, and that is I found it very interesting about a month ago to have a couple of revelations come out, and one of them was that in K through 12 funding, we're higher than 37 other states. But when it comes to dropout rate, we're higher than 49 other states. And my question is has anybody looked at the total cost, Paul, I guess this is to you, at the total cost of the whole SIM and CAM scheme and whether or not we're getting the bang for the buck? Because if you looked at those numbers, total funding higher than 37 other states, K through 12, dropout rate number one, it would tell you if you were analyzing a business that there must be something wrong. And I wondered, have we had any evaluation? I know initially they said that the SIM and CAM process could cost $500 million a year. And is it costing that much? And are we getting the bang for those bucks?
Yeah, I think we could have presentations on that. I think I would ask possibly that somebody from the Education Committee who's looking at those things come and make a presentation for us.
I see a smile down there.
Yeah.
Chair, I think that is really important. We looked at a lot of the issues surrounding the dropout rate. I think that one of the things perhaps that we haven't looked at as closely as we ought, we had a report during the last year that our fourth graders tested below the national average in reading. Mm-hmm. Imagine an eighth grader who cannot read and cannot compete, cannot learn, and in school.
Right.
I think we've had lots of testimony in the years I've been here that teaching children to read is the number one problem. And if we did that early, like in the first grade, we could save a very large percentage of the school budget.
Yeah. Actually, I think the governor's budget, as proposed, recognizes and reprioritizes early intervention for a host of things. And cognitive skills like reading at an early age is one of those. And I guess, the focus of this committee can be to look at the dollars and the revenue streams. But we should support the public policy discussions that are going on elsewhere in the building. So I think we really do need to ask the Education Committee to intertie. Senator Starr, you will be pleased to know that today's announcement was made that eighth graders in Oregon are reading ninth in the nation and writing ninth in the nation. So there's been significant improvement in a fairly short period of time, at least in that class of kids. So, and it's tough for us to figure as lay people, and perhaps some are more skilled than others having had education experience, how to make these measurements work. You know, what factors do we look at? But again, I think our job here is to make sure the tools in terms of financing revenue streams are in the toolbox, and then we'll connect those with policy decisions as we go. I'm really pleased that the committee is so interested in the education issue since it's better than half the budget. Can we move on?
Okay, just two final points on the schools, Mr. Chair. One is that even though we've gone to a much more centralized revenue system for schools, we still have 30% of that revenue is from local property taxes. And that's projected and estimated. There's some estimates that were in the governor's budget. Those will be updated for you in around May 1st. So you'll get some updated numbers on that before you make the final decisions on the revenue for schools. The other issue is to remind you that the governor's budget does treat those additional federal forest receipts as current law does. Mm-hmm. There's no recommended notation to change that. So. That translates into about $14 million per year. Mm-hmm. So if that's treated differently, then that affects that where that budget is developed. The next subject area I have...
Can we regress for just a second? Sure. I think that we need to recognize that the governor had no choice but to include those dollars as a current statute dictate. It's a mandatory requirement. I don't think that precludes us from looking at different potentials, but the governor had no choice except to follow the current state statute.
The second area is on corporate income and excise taxes. And there are always a lot of bills you'll see dealing with corporate income taxes. It is the most complicated thing that the Department of Revenue has to do, because you're administering a tax. You're trying to determine a base for multinational corporations, what portion of their economic activity is in Oregon and can be assigned to Oregon. And that in and of itself is a very complicated task. But what I've listed here are three areas that do have significant revenue implications. One is the income apportionment formula. Currently, we use what's called a three-factor formula, where we include payroll, property, and sales that can be identified in Oregon. We take the portion of a company's national activities, national property, national payroll, national sales, and they use that as the income tax base for Oregon. We do use an extra weight on sales. We have double-weighted sales in that formula. We had a bill recommended that did pass the Senate last session that would have gone to what we call a single sales factor, in which Oregon's corporate income tax base would be determined solely by the proportion of sales that can be attributed to Oregon. It would not be tied to property or payroll in Oregon. That bill was amended in the House to make it 80% sales, 10% property, 10% payroll, so what we call super-weighted sales. It passed both houses in an amended form, but the governor vetoed the bill. So that issue, I suspect, will be back before you to review. There's been a lot of discussion about this at the national level. A number of states have gone in this direction. We have quite a bit of information for you on that. It's also something we hope to use our new tax incidence model to analyze what the implications of that measure might be. So that's a fundamental issue for you to consider in terms of how we tax corporations and how we measure their base for taxation purposes. The other two issues are the two largest credits in terms of impact on the revenue stream, the pollution control facilities credit and the research activities credit. Both of them are scheduled to sunset at the end of the 2001 calendar year. The numbers there are a little misleading in terms of the revenue impact because these are credits that are based on certified projects. So, for example, in the pollution control facilities credit, if that were to sunset at the end of 01, there wouldn't be an additional $31 million right away in terms of revenue because projects that have been certified would slowly be phased out. So to give you a sense, these are 10-year projects. It's roughly $3 million per year. So if it were allowed to sunset, you would see revenue grow roughly $3 million a year, between 6, 9, 12, and so forth.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator George.
Paul, yesterday I had someone from some folks in from DEQ, and I was asking them about a bill that I had heard about from the environmental community and even Associated Oregon Industries, and the idea that if a company is meeting all of its DEQ EPA standards and they were to go beyond those standards and go for greater reductions, that there was going to be these kind of credits applied to them. Have you heard, is anything popped out in the hopper on that? Are we going to be considering that?
Senator, this issue has been discussed quite a bit in recent years in terms of, you know, what incentives are you providing? I think the basic issue is, are you trying to provide just incentives for environmental behavior, environmentally positive production facilities, or is it an economic development tool that basically reduces the cost of capital and encourages investment? So you'll hear both of those arguments, and so that I think is one of the key issues you'll have to determine. Exactly what do you want to do with that credit?
Mm-hmm.
The way this is laid out is whether you want to sunset or not. Really, I think another issue here is you want to
both
keep it and modify it.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly within your purview as well. So it's something that's been on the books since the 60s. That's one of our longest-serving corporate income tax credits. So it's probably worthwhile to review that and think of it in terms of policy, exactly what you're trying to accomplish with it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Castillo.
Paul, Paul, were you going to, I don't think I understand what a research activities credit is. Are you going to explain this? Unless maybe everybody else on this committee understands what it is, but I don't.
And I have a feeling Mr. Warner is going to.
Senator, it's a credit for investment in certain research activities. It's really has its biggest effect in the high-tech industry, where you're encouraging expenditures on research activities.
And there may be applications in medical technology.
Yeah.
We've been reading a lot and hearing a lot from Oregon Health Sciences University
right.
about the potential of connecting research with marketplace incentives
mm-hmm.
and allowing new partnerships between researchers and patentable technology, which could really open a lot of opportunity for all Oregonians, but particularly in high medical technology areas. So we might have a new application for this.
Yeah, and in fact, we're being asked to increase the amount, right, rather than just letting the sunset, but my understanding was.
Yeah, and actually I think we'll get into the classic argument about what is the current cost and what is the future worth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, governmental programs, some of them produce revenue, but it's future revenue against existing immediate expenditures.
Yeah.
So it's the old trade-off thing we'll have to make. Try to be intelligent for the long haul.
And Mr. Chair, and one of the issues that was discussed at length in the last session, particularly in the House committee, was the use of sunsets. And, you know, we're seeing them here, and I think you'll see them more and more, that tax credits and other elements of tax law are sunsetted, so you do go through this review process. So it becomes built into the system. And so this is an example of that.
Did that catch it, Senator?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
The next subject area listed there was excise taxes, and you recall from yesterday, we impose very little tax burden on consumption. So if you are thinking in terms of revenue increasing measures, this tends to be the focus. All of these measures, these issues I've suggested here, of course, would originate in the House. But if they do get through the House, they would come here immediately. We have had a process beginning with 93, in which there's a 10-cent per pack surcharge on cigarettes that has a 2-year sunset. And so it was 93 to 96, then 98, and so on. And the 99 session extended that sunset from January 1, 2000 to January 1, 2002. These dollars go to the health plan, so it has been a funding mechanism used over time. And we'll talk with you about where Oregon stands in terms of cigarette taxes. We are relatively high at 68 cents per pack, but our northern and southern neighbors are even higher. So we do get concerned in terms of revenue and try to include that in our impacts when we have differentials in those excise tax rates, and because it will affect revenue if you have a lot higher or lower excise tax than neighbors. The other issues, I've listed beer and wine excise taxes here, not because it's a recommendation, but because we've seen some bills in this area, and it is a additional area that has been looked at, partially because of its allocation. It is allocated to mental health and some other programs under the current formula. But it's an issue to look at. I've also listed just the other excise taxes. And there's certainly some economic rationale to impose excise taxes, either to try to compensate for social costs, which is certainly part of the argument for excise taxes on cigarettes, but also when you're trying to match benefits with costs, it's a way to fund particularly public service activities. If you can isolate who's the beneficiary, or who's at least partially the beneficiary, and impose a tax to help fund that activity. So that's, if you think in terms of revenue raising, this is an area where you're likely to go in terms of the current system, the way it's set up.
The governor's budget
assume the extension of the sunset on the 10 cent per pack surcharge on cigarettes. His budget includes that to revenue.
Okay. The next area is on the personal income tax, and that is one in which, of course, we, as we emphasized yesterday, the income tax is overwhelmingly the largest source for general fund revenue and overwhelmingly largest source for state tax revenue in general. We do have some proposals. Last time there was some discussion, and this time proposals as well, on capital gains tax rate reduction. Currently, capital gains are taxed as ordinary income. We have seen at the federal level a fairly significant reduction in the tax rate on capital gains. Went into place in 96, where now for long-term capital gains, the maximum rate is 20%. So essentially is half of what the top rate can be for ordinary income at the federal level. So the proposal here is to reduce the top rate on capital gains to 4% rather than the 9% we currently have as part of ordinary income. Again, we don't have our tax incidence model. We're thinking in terms of how to apply the capital gains to that model. It's not a straightforward, but we think the model will give us some real insights in terms of the implications of reducing capital gains. One thing to keep in mind about capital gains is that we have capital in Oregon versus investment in capital generally. We have to make that distinction. Most capital gains come from the stock market, and we talked about how important that's become. So that's an issue to sort through, and one that I think will that becomes a serious issue if you want to spend a lot of time on. Low-income tax relief has been an issue in 97-99. We have a working family credit, and we also have a earned income tax credit, which is a proportion of the federal. Those were established in 97. This committee, the Senate Revenue Committee, spent weeks on that issue, looking at the various elements to our earned income tax credits, and ended up passing a bill that was modified somewhat by the House, but went into effect. In 99, Senator Adams proposed a bill, Senate Bill 2, that did expand the working family credit. So we've had a legislative history here over the last couple of sessions, and we see some other bills in that area as well, either to modify the existing structure or to expand it. A marriage penalty is an issue you've heard quite a bit about, I'm sure, at the federal level. In terms of Oregon law, it shows up in a standard deduction, where the standard deduction for single filers is less than twice the standard deduction, or the standard deduction for joint filers is less than twice the standard deduction for single filers. So in other words, you get a bigger standard deduction if you have two single people, rather than having them get married and live together. So that's an issue that the House spent some time on last session, ended up passing a bill. The problem that the House dealt with is to do it in the most straightforward manner, just to increase the joint standard deduction so it's double the single, costs you about $20 million in revenue. So you confront that classic trade-off with revenue loss. They did end up passing a bill that lowered the single deduction and made the two made it basically revenue neutral and set them so that there would be no penalty, but that measure did not pass.
Is that $20 million a year?
That would be $20 million for the biennium, estimate last biennium. So we would have to redo that and look at that again if we get a bill of that nature. Some other income tax issues. There has been a task force working through the interim on to encourage contributions to the arts, and Senator Beyer has been very active in that area, along with Representative Westland. And there's one way to encourage that is through the use of an income tax credit. And so we anticipate some bills in that area to look at encouraging that activity. We automatically reconnect to the federal tax base, and there's changes in federal law, but the responsibility of the legislature is to review the implications of that, and it is still very much at your discretion whether you want to do that or not, whether you think it's wise policy. The legislative policy has never been into a situation where you just abrogate those decisions to the federal level. It's a state law decision. So even though we automatically reconnect during the interim, the revenue committees go through and review what that means and make the final decision whether that's a good policy for Oregon or not. And so we'll go through that process. It is actually a little bit less, it's a little bit less of a task than it has been in the last couple of sessions, because there hasn't been that much federal legislation to reconnect to. But nevertheless, it's an important role to play. The final issue is interstate tax issues. We always have a series of them. We've got one dealing with how we tax the workers on the Columbia River with Washington. We've got one in terms of non-residents, how you treat non-residents, how you establish not whether somebody's a part of your resident or not. And the Revenue Department plays an important role in helping you get through those issues and how they currently deal with some of those complex questions as to determining what people's tax liability is. Can I proceed into property taxes?
I think so.
Property taxes. We have the legacy of Measure 50. I think you'll find that you hear a lot less probably from your constituents and complaining about property tax bills. But one of the legacies has been a very complicated property tax system, and there are a lot of issues that remain from that. The ones I've listed at the beginning are ones that are really came up from last session, particularly those first four. House Bill 3575 that passed in 99 represented a significant change in the way the timber is taxed. It eliminated the timber privilege tax, phased it out for large land holdings. For those with small woodland owners, less than 5,000 acres, it gave them an option and established a task force to look at how legislation should proceed for those small woodland owners. Revenue Department has been very much involved in that process, and they will have some reports to you on their recommendations on how to deal with that. The other element of the issue is, as we shift away from a privilege tax to a full property tax-based timber taxation system, forest land assessed values become much more important. And there's been a task force looking at that, a work group that has gone through that, in which the Revenue Department has had consultants and representatives from the industry work with them closely to try to determine what would be appropriate forest land values under Measure 50. So that becomes a complicated area, and you'll see some legislation in that area. The second one is intangibles. This has been one where the legislature has passed two bills, both in 97 and both in 99, and both were vetoed by the governor, essentially because of concerns over revenue impact. Currently, intangible property of centrally assessed property, largely utilities, is taxed as part of the property tax base. It is not part of the property tax base for non-centrally assessed property. So there's been a pressure from the centrally assessed property owners to move away from intangibles and exclude them from the base, as a number of states have done. So that's an issue that may come up, and could come up any number of points. It could be broad, could be some more narrowly based proposals in which industries to exclude intangibles. One of the complicating factors about this issue is these are industries that are undergoing significant deregulation. Mm-hmm. Their very nature and structure is changing in significant ways, who their competitors are. And you'll hear a lot about that in that discussion.
Paul, would an example of an intangible be the ability to buy a Bonneville Power Administration as a preference customer, or the ability to do business as a business entity that really, how do you tax an inventory of electrical energy or services that are delivered? Is that the kind of thing we're talking about here?
Well, no, I think of it more in terms of licenses, patents, those more. Now, the rights to buy something I would think would be, but I'm not positive.
Okay. We'll get further into the definitions.
It becomes a very complicated area because these The thing that we do know in terms of intangibles is their share of value is growing very rapidly. Mm-hmm. Maybe Elizabeth could help us on that. Elizabeth? We have an intangible question for you.
I know. Maybe 11 years ago.
Yes,
Chairman Ferrioli and members of the committee, just for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin Mahar. And can you repeat your question? I was
actually
talking to Dexter.
Ma'am, I just asked for a couple of examples of intangibles for my benefit in the committee.
Some of them that we talked about during the 99 session were like FCC licenses, and that's something that we kind of saw even another version of the bill. Other things that kind of come to mind, each utility has different types of intangibles, and so that's kind of something that made some of the process kind of hard, was because that each industry group kind of had their own idea of what kind of things should be intangibles. And things like another issue that was brought up was like the Trojan nuclear power plant, whether or not that should be considered an intangible, because it's something that at this time they're not making a profit off of it. And so that was something that was excluded from intangibles last session because it did have a real big revenue impact in Columbia County. And so that's a couple examples. But we, you know, we've got a whole kind of a list of them and things from our last interim group that we can sure share with you if you'd like it, kind of broken out by different utility type.
Are there any implications for commerce on the internet or e-commerce businesses?
We did not talk about e-commerce.
Okay. One of the issues you'll find, Mr. Chair, there is quite a bit of disagreement over the size of those intangibles, what's the value of them, and you know how big a chunk are they. Mm-hmm. The Revenue Department has spent a lot of effort in trying to estimate that, but as you can imagine, there's quite a variation in the estimates. So what's included and what is the value of some of the things that aren't included.
Sure.
And also how you get at that. You know, I mean, do you use the cost approach versus the income approach? And that was what it was a lot of discussion in the beginning of that intangible group was the telecommunications industry really wanted to have the cost approach. And they felt like by having the cost approach, you'd just be eliminating all intangibles. And that was something that, you know, then there was discussion on why you should be using Department of Revenue uses a blending of the cost and income approach. And that was something that they felt like was important to have. So those are the kind of issues that we dealt with at that time, you know, not even sometimes even identifying individual, you know, intangibles. I mean, as much as like the telecommunications, like I said, they just wanted a cost approach versus an income approach.
Poles and wire.
Yeah.
Switching facilities, satellite, link us, et cetera, as opposed to the value of the commerce generated from us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The interim committee did a report.
Chairman Ferrioli, that was during the 99 session. Okay, so that was not this past interim, but the 99 session right before, you know, like in the end of 98, we had a few meetings, October, November, December. Mm-hmm. Department of Revenue was ahead of that. Elizabeth Harchenko, I'm head of that group.
So I guess what that would proceed from that is there must be a legislative history on this issue. And maybe the... so is Elizabeth Harchenko the person to bring forward, or would we ask you for a brief synopsis, something from a report or something that the committee could review?
You could always hope that no one...
Senator Ferrioli.
A homework assignment.
Maybe we could just start with, I could give you some of the old... you know, revenue impacts, and then, you know, show you some of the intangibles that were identified during the interim group that I know I have. And then if you want more information, you know, you can talk with Elizabeth and maybe bring her in.
Well, I guess the hearing from the groans of the committee members that are more experienced, I guess I'd ask you to just provide some background for us with a limit of 2 pages.
Oh, 2 pages.
Put it on 2 pages just to give us some vocabulary and a bit of familiarity. And, yes, Senator.
and end the two pages with zero sum.
Yeah, that's what we play. That's what good Senator Adams told us over and over again in the last session.
Oh, right.
The good Republican leadership told us over and over again in the last three sessions, zero sum.
Works both ways.
I think it's one of those things that for new members of the committee, it's, and maybe for experienced members, it's a hard thing to get your mind around.
Well, an advantage this time is that the last time we talked about it, there's some rapid sort of activity in telecom, and I suspect we probably have a little more history of what's happened in the values of those businesses. For example, the sale of the wireless systems licenses. You know, there was one group of them was virtually given away, and another group went to the highest bidder. So you have the same business, maybe in the same community, priced at a different level. And that was one of the criticisms of the logic.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, that's an example of the complicated nature of the property tax issues, and the others that follow.
Well, we'll be assigning that issue to the House Committee.
Well, first.
Yeah.
They love this stuff. Ag processing equipment is another one that there was an interim work group that worked on with the counties and the wine growers and the farm Bureau that were interested in looking at how we treat processing equipment and personal property and how that's assessed and concerns about that and there is a interim House Revenue Committee bill that was a result of that work group.
And this issue has been suggested to the committee as a field trip opportunity in Columbia County and some other areas where some of this equipment has been put into use producing Oregon wines. So we'll do field hearings in the probably won't happen so.
We'll combine them with the Education Committee, Mr. Chair.
Another area is on historic property, and there is some confusion in the law about the length of time of a frozen value. This value is frozen and not increased in value while it's under historic property. There's a 15-year period in which it's frozen. Then you can reapply for another 15-year period, and there's some question as to what the base is, what's the appropriate base, and what period is it frozen to. The Department of Revenue does have a bill to look at, and I think you'll see some other proposals as well. That will try to clarify that and what's the proper treatment of assessed value for that historic property. Urban renewal has been an area that has a number of complicated aspects to it. It is I listed here because it is a very significant element of the property tax system, and it's one that is because of its complexity. There's a lot of misunderstandings about it. And it's something that you may want to look at as a significant public policy issue. And it's the relationships within the property tax system changed as a result of Measure 50. Low-income housing is an issue that's an important one in terms of public policy and what kinds of things you want to do around low-income housing. We do have a bill before us that was brought by the assessors to the House Interim Revenue Committee on some controversy about how to deal with owners who have agreed to charge below market rent and how they should be properly assessed. We have some Measure 50 cleanup from the department. We have enterprise zone legislation that is kind of one you typically see during the session, enterprise zone, to try to look at the options and how to make it a more effective local economic development tool. And Economic Development Department, I know, has at least a couple of bills in dealing with that.
Mm-hmm.
Inverse taxing districts is an idea of the chairs, and one that I'll let you explain, Mr. Chair.
Well, this is an opportunity for local communities to try to incent revitalization of housing stocks. Typically, what happens in tax policy is that
two properties that are situated side by side that may be identical in square footage and improvements. One that shows a significant amount of deferred maintenance and unrepaired wear and tear, typically over time would be taxed at a lower rate. And perhaps it becomes a non-owner-occupied property over time. If many of these properties are featured in a neighborhood, what happens is you get obsolescence and some declining values in the community, and you end up with a an area that you could be described it could be described as blighted. But the values tend to multiply the effect, and the value curve depresses the values of neighboring properties. The theory is that if those negative values are assessed properly by the local taxing district, we're actually incentivizing deferred maintenance and a degradation of the local housing stock. If the values were, if the assessments were flipped over and then a tax assessment was provided that disincentivized deferred maintenance and gave the property tax benefit to the properties that were being maintained as Class 1 housing stock, rather than penalizing those Class 1 houses that have had a proper maintenance and improvements over time. Because as the value rises, the tax bite rises. If you flip that logic over and try to disincentivize the deterioration with a higher tax value, and you can argue that you provide more services to a deteriorating housing stock, more police, more fire, more health services. They're more costly in terms of public health issues, et cetera. You can possibly justify higher taxes for more deterioration. Clearly, these houses over the economic life enter a stage where they tend to be non-owner-occupied rental housing. And the cure for these issues would be to incentivize rehabilitation of the housing stock and reentry of that as an owner-occupied home. So we've talked to some of the cities that have looked at the inverse taxing proposal and would like to try it as an experiment in tax-incentivized renewal of housing stock.
Mr. Chairman. Has anyone did any of those groups do any studies of Europe? Because I understand some European countries do exactly what you're describing. You make improvements and your taxes go down. You allow it to deteriorate and your taxes go up.
Yeah.
And I know there'd have to be some balances in there for the ability of a person to maintain, but at the same time, I agree with you that this is right now is an incentive not to, to repair or maintain. Particularly if you don't, it's not your own self-pride of your ownership and your occupying of that home. So,
well,
if anyone actually looked at how some of the European models work.
Actually, I think I have not, but I hope the community does take an opportunity to get more information. Some members of the League of Oregon Cities have expressed interest, at least in the concept. And, it's not intended to be an experiment in socialism, but what it is, I hope, will be an experiment in providing a new kind of incentive for improved housing stock. We'll just see where that one goes. Paul.
The last one under property taxes listed there is the personal property exemption threshold. This is aimed at small businesses that have personal property. If it's less than $10,000, then it's exempt from property taxes. This was increased in 97. There was a bill in 99 that would increase it further, and I would anticipate some more bills along those lines as well to increase that exemption amount. I've seen one, I believe, to 20,000. So that would be another issue that may come before you.
Is that coming from the Revenue Department? Seems like last time we dealt with that, it was the Revenue Department efficiency recommendation.
If you're not to be claiming that.
Claiming it this time.
That's a policy issue. Okay. The final area is kind of just two things that I put out there that I suspect you'll be looking at some bills. I know you have one on a stabilization fund already that's a committee bill, a joint resolution. Measure 76 passed in November of last year, of 99, and requires that heavy and light vehicles pay the highway taxes and fees equivalent to their cost responsibility. We have a new cost responsibility study that will be finalized next week. We have scheduled a presentation of that before the House Revenue Committee next Friday afternoon, all members of the Senate Committee are welcome to attend that. It'll be Friday afternoon at 1:30 next Friday, and that will be a presentation by the contractors of that new cost allocation result. Depending what the final results are, there may be some changes that you might want to consider in terms of adjusting taxes and fees so that you're matching those estimates on what cost responsibility is among the two large weight classes.
I know the committee's anxious to weigh into the weight mile issues and the cost responsibility questions. Maybe it's just anxiety that I'm
Senator George will consider this in his committee as well.
I'm good.
Been there, done that kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe it's something that we can appoint Senator George as a subcommittee of one.
Well, I am setting up a subcommittee of a few experts to review it, so we probably could have that report made to this committee. Yeah. Yeah. That might be a good thing, because I'm going to set up a work group to review it.
And I have a feeling that we'll have ample opportunity to hear from folks that really have strong feelings about cost responsibility issues. We'll get our share here too.
The stabilization fund issue is one that has been talked about a fair amount in the last couple of sessions. You may recall a former Speaker Lundquist had some proposals in the 97 session. Mm-hmm. The governor's tax review group recommended a stabilization fund in the 99 session. But currently, Oregon does not have a formal reserve fund. And Measure 89, actually, I don't know how much public debate there was over this element of it. I don't recall much, but Measure 89 very much had a stabilization fund in it. The principle was not to be used, the principle from the tobacco settlement revenue, not to be used unless certain economic criteria were met, specifically two declining quarters of employment, which was an approximation of a recession.
Is that $429 million? The total tobacco fund.
The total tobacco fund revenue that and if nothing is spent between now and July 1 of 2003, would be about $350 million.
$350 million.
So, but the issue of a stabilization fund is one that may well come up as a key issue for you. We have. I also wanted to remind you of something I said yesterday, and that is that the House Revenue Committee tomorrow at 1:30 will be meeting here, and we'll be talking about some of the risks to the revenue forecast and looking at possible recession scenarios. We have the state economist in, and also Bill Connolly from the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors. So I'll be in this room at 1:30 tomorrow.
And the before we leave off the stabilization fund, the governor's budget does feature a $100 million cash carryover from the tobacco fund. It isn't a stabilization fund by any sense or stretch. It's just a cash carryover. But it's interesting to note how many ways the proposals have come forward for the use of the tobacco settlement revenue. Well, that brings us to the end of the discussions. Have we concluded our discussions with the House Committee about allocation of issues?
Mr. Chair, the House is fine with a suggested division that we had talked about. So I think we can proceed on that. One of the limitations that will come up for them divisions is exactly who gets what bills and whether any of these House or Senate may cause some adjustment there. And we don't know how all those will turn out, but that suggested the division House Chair is fine with that division.
Okay.
So I think what that'll do is allow the two committees to really focus on some areas and kind of split some responsibility, because number of these are ones you could spend an awful lot of time on. So I think it's a good way to divide up the responsibility.
Are you looking at a piece of paper we don't have?
Well, actually, it's an addition, a later addition, but in fact, the recapitulation that you just had incorporates all of those topics.
Which is going to start where?
On our side. Paul's basically just done that, but I have made copies for every member if you'd like to have those now. I was scheduling a meeting with each member, so I have meetings with Senator Castillo today, and I met with Senator George yesterday, and talked to Senator Menace and Senator Starr, and others have been asked for schedules, but I do have the same handout if you'd like to have it early,
sure,
perhaps. Senator George, I don't know if you got your copy yesterday, but there it is. And I'll leave one for the committee administrator to put in record if you'd like to. But it is just basically the same topics that we've just discussed. Is that what we have to accomplish today, Mr. Manager?
On Monday, we will start looking at the major revenue areas, and we'll start off with personal income tax.
Great. And do we have any bills scheduled for our committee to...
Why ask?
Mr. Chairman, we've got bills that are now in possession of the committee. I'll look through those, and we plan to check with you on putting a couple on the agenda for next week.
Well, if we could just have those welded into a steel drum in your office until further notice, that would be good.
Okay.
Any other questions or bills to come before the committee? If not, hearing none, we are in adjournment until Monday at 8:30 a.m. Same location.